Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, Tariq Ali on the future of Palestine. I hope you'll stay tuned. Tariq Ali is a left-leaning scholar and writer now living in London. He's the editor of New Left Review, and he's the author of more than a dozen books. He is a fine and articulate critic of the U.S. and British foreign policies. Tariq Ali was born in 1943 in Lahore, Pakistan. His parents had converted from Islam to atheism and communism, and Tariq has followed somewhat similar paths. In May 2016, he spoke at the Left Forum in New York. He was on a panel along with the American scholar and critic of Zionism, Norman Finkelstein. Ali and Finkelstein discussed the sad situation of the people of Palestine. They have suffered under a brutal and illegal blockade and military occupation by Israel, the occupation now nearly 50 years long. Today, we'll hear Tariq Ali's remarks exclusively, and we'll hear from Finkelstein in the near future. In his talk, Ali says remarkably little about Israel. In fact, he begins by condemning the people of the Palestinian Authority, the corrupt puppet government in Palestine established by and funded by the Israeli occupiers and by the United States. Ali moves on to the worldwide BDS campaign, the campaign to pressure Israel to end its oppression of Palestine through boycott, divestment, and sanctions against Israel and Israeli products. Ali sees BDS as a good idea, but not sufficient to save Palestine. The Palestinian people need to form an organized mass movement too, as the South Africans did. And the Palestinian people will have to do it independently of Palestine's corrupt so-called leaders. Ali also touches on why the two-state solution is no longer a viable option for Palestine, and on how occupied Palestine is different from the old apartheid South Africa, and on why the Bernie Sanders movement is so encouraging. It's a wide-ranging intellectual tour de force and well worth a listen. Maybe several listens. On the past and future of Palestine, here is Tariq Ali.
I think if we are brutally honest, we have to say that the Palestinian organizations, especially the Palestinian Liberation Organization, which negotiated the Oslo Accords, has participated and collaborated in the defeat that has been inflicted on the Palestinian people.
They want you to hold the mic a little higher.
I think this collaboration was absolutely vital for the Israelis in order to do what they are now doing. And I think the debate and discussion that has now opened up, even within the PLO, is an indication that everyone now knows, there's no secret, not that they didn't know it before, that this is the way they were going. And for a long time it was difficult to say it. I mean, I've been saying it for 10, 15 years in different parts of the world, including at conferences organized by Palestinians themselves. And in private, a lot of them would agree, you're right, but we can't say it in public. I said, you have to say it in public. It shouldn't be left to people like me to say it. You have to say it. Because saying it will be helpful and will not allow the people to get too demoralized. If no one opens their mouths from within the leadership or lower echelons or lower ranking cadres of that organization, we are sunk. And in fact, as we know, the scale of the collaboration was huge. Of the money given to the Palestinian, so-called Palestinian Authority, which was Palestinian but which had no authority at all, because never was there a Palestinian Authority. From the beginning, the real authority was the IDF, and behind it the Israeli government, and behind it the White House and the State Department, i.e. the United States of America. So there was never any Palestinian authority. What they had was a budget. Billions came in. A majority segment of this budget was spent on what? Security. Security, let's see what is meant by security. Defending the Palestinian people against the onslaughts of the IDF? No, perish the thought. The security they talked about was to keep their own people under control and to deal with rival factions of Palestinians in Gaza, etc. That's what the bulk of the money was spent on. Where did some of the rest of the money go? It went in enriching those who were organizing this so-called Palestinian Authority. Political leaders, including right at the very top, low-level cadres, they were bought off and told, we've struggled enough, let's enjoy life for a bit. But you know, we're all in favor of enjoying life for a bit if your own people aren't living in such dire and desperate conditions. And this is what was completely ignored. And you know, I have a very dear friend, a Palestinian poet who lives in Cairo, who told me when I went to Ramallah, a close friend of mine, we had fought together in the old days, took me up the mountain and showed me his brand new villa, which must have cost God knows, you know, $500,000 or the equivalent thereof. And he said, look, this is how I live now and I'm happy. And he said, I felt like slapping his face, because not so far away were people who were living in really appalling conditions. And this money, which could have been used to aid every Palestinian family, to build schools, to build small clinics, etc., etc., was frittered away. And the Israelis knew what they were doing. They were buying off the top layers of Palestinian society within the PLO. And we have now reached a situation where I was at a conference in Spain, in Cordoba, a few weeks ago, sharing a platform with the Palestinian Minister for Finance and Economics, and everything I've said to you, I said to his face. And he admitted, he said, yeah, perhaps we spent too much on security. And I said, what about the $2 billion bribe scandal? And he said, that's exaggerated. No open denial. It's a huge tragedy that the leaders of a movement could be bought off and bought off so easily. So he then turned to me and said, well, what would you do? I said, for one thing, what I would do now really, because enough is enough, is say to the world at large, there is no authority, there is no Palestinian authority. We are going to dump it. It doesn't exist. We are just Palestinians in this region which is occupied by Israel, and dear world and dear people in the world, that's what we are. Are you going to help us? Please do. If not, we'll struggle on and live together and share each other's goods and money as long as we can, because that is what is needed. And he said, well, there's a logic in what you say, but I said the logic, if it exists for you, has come too bloody late for the Palestinian people. They know what you've done. The Israelis do horrific things, as Norman has eloquently described and has been describing for years. But I said, being defeated by your own leadership is psychologically and politically very damning. That is much more difficult to get over. Because you then say, what alternative do we have? Where are we going? So I say that as long as this is recognized, and they are beginning to recognize it, it's difficult not to, that they have lost the battle for a Palestinian state. That that Palestinian state which they dreamed of, even on the 67 frontiers, is not going to happen because the occupation settlements have just encroached too far into Palestinian territory. There is no Israeli government which is going to remove them because it won't have the support of its own population to do so. The United States is indifferent, always has been indifferent to the fate of the Palestinians, and more so after the 67 war. So there's going to be no help from the so-called international community, by which is just a code word for referring to the United States. There's no such thing as an international community. So in this situation, far better that the Palestinians acknowledge of their situation and then see how to proceed forward. The situation is grim. It's pointless prettifying it or finding hope in tiny things. Not that these tiny things are not important. The BDS campaign is important. It's important not because it'll bring down the Israeli government. That is an illusion, that it will bring down the Israeli government. The South African government was not brought down by sanctions. It was brought down by the defeat inflicted by the Cuban army on South Africa. But sanctions on their own are never decisive. I nonetheless support them. Why? Because it is an important way to project what is going on in the world of Israel and Palestine and in the world at large, and on that front it's been effective. The reason the Israeli government is so hostile to it is not that they feel threatened by the sanctions, but because it disgraces them. It shames them. They have to answer questions about it. When campuses in the United States or parts of Europe stand up and say, we demand a boycott of Israel, it shames even the American government, which finds this horrifying, and European governments, which have done absolutely nothing to aid the Palestinians. So these movements, societal movements from below, are extremely important from that particular vantage point, and that's why I was a signatory to it, from the beginning, without any illusions, but understanding its importance. And this is why now there's a huge campaign. They've outlawed BDS in France, which, by the way, is the most pro-Israeli country in Europe today. And the appointment of Mark Negev, a friend of Netanyahu's and formerly Netanyahu's press officer, who you probably saw complacent and unctuous on television screens defending the indefensible, is now the ambassador in London to see if he can persuade the conservative government to do what the French have done and make BDS activities illegal. And allied to this comes a new campaign, which is not new, of course, in the United States, but is new in large parts of Europe, whereby the chief rabbi in Britain said there is no such thing as anti-Zionism that is not also anti-Semitism. Actually said this, and said that anti-Zionism, people who talk about anti-Zionism, are anti-Semitic. Of course, liberal Jews and the Jewish Voices for Peace, thankfully there are many more of these still in British society than the other, came out very strongly denouncing this. So there is a debate going on, and you ask yourself, why is it that suddenly this campaign of anti-Semitism got sparked off in Britain? That's because the Labour Party, to its own horror and shock, has elected a leader who is very well known for being a defender of the Palestinian cause and the Palestinian movement. And And it is this that has panicked them. So they're denouncing people in his circles, etc. Sometimes Ken Livingstone, the former mayor of London, says something which is three quarters accurate, but not 100%, and says it in a temper without rationally arguing it. So they pounce on him. Or another member of parliament who 2 years ago forwarded one of Norm's texts and satirical blogs, satire is fatal these days, satirical blogs saying that all the Israeli Jews could of course come back and live in the United States if they wanted to, since many of them went from Brooklyn and so whatever. So this is so obviously a satirical blog, and she found it amusing and forwarded it. She's been accused of anti-Semitism because she was foolish. Instead of saying this is a blog by Norman Finkelstein, I forwarded, then they could deal with Norman directly. But instead, she panicked and apologized and went on her knees. They've still suspended her from the Labour Party. Because the worst thing to do in these situations is not to fight back. If you don't fight back, they carry on and on and on. So this is what's going on. And you know, the irony of the situation is that if you want to know the community in Europe which is really suffering, it is the Muslim communities. Yeah. There is a huge wave of Islamophobia in many parts of Europe, I would say virtually all of Europe, which in its manifestations is not that different from the attacks that were made on Jewish people in the 20s and 30s and even in the 40s and even in the 50s after the Second World War. A lot of the arguments being used against Muslims are very similar. Someone has actually done an analysis of what was written about the Jews and what is being written about the Muslims. Almost exactly the same. And yet, does anyone care? No, well, we do. But by and large, this is completely ignored because the media is a part of it. So that is the situation that we confront, and of course, you know, we fight it back. But the Palestinians have to understand, and I think increasingly they do, that the state they visualized is impossible. So the only hope, I can't see any other way out, is a solution which many staunch Israeli anti-Zionists from the Matzpen group and others have defended for a long time. And many of them educated me in this whole idea about 40 years ago, that the only viable long-term solution is a single Israeli-Palestinian state with equal rights for Jews, Muslims, Christians, Palestinians, Druids, whatever. I won't get involved in an argument with Norm on Gandhi at this particular forum. I must say my views on Gandhi coming from that subcontinent are very different from the idealized picture which has been developed of him, not just by Norm, but by Western society as a whole. Interestingly enough, I can't resist telling you this, that in 1938, the Nobel Peace Prize Committee had a shortlist of people in front of it, and they couldn't decide whether to give the Nobel Peace Prize to Mahatma Gandhi, who, whatever my disagreements, certainly deserved it. They couldn't decide whether to give it to Mahatma Gandhi or Adolf Hitler. Which shows how deep Western dilemmas go. But anyway, I agree on Gaza, of course. I would just say to Norman that what he's described, of course, another political theorist of a current, he now doesn't like the Bolsheviks, also once asserted that the chain breaks at its weakest link. And quoting Lenin's words, one can also reach the same conclusion that the weakest link in the chain of oppression in Israel-Palestine today is without doubt Gaza. And one should concentrate efforts, all possible efforts, to try and break the blockade. I'm completely in favor of that, have supported all the ships that have gone and all the different campaigns that have been involved. But that would be a huge leap forward and would possibly revitalize a mass movement in the rest of the region, because it's true, I took it for granted that the Cubans inflicting a military defeat on this vaunted, you know, white South African army was a huge blow to them. And Nelson Mandela, the first country he visited after he was released was Cuba. He said we owed them a blood debt, because without that defeat we might have been stuck for some time to come. But it goes without granted, there's a huge mass movement in South Africa, which varied, it was crushed, it rose again. You had new mass movements in Soweto and the townships. You then had armed struggle, strikes, guerrilla actions, which weren't so successful, by the way, even in South Africa. And then the Cuban triumph, and then we know the history. But the point I was going to make was that even with the blockade on Gaza being lifted, which would create the basis for a new, different type of mass movement of the Palestinians and their few allies in that region, we still have to have some overall plan, which will not be fulfilled today or tomorrow or the day after. And that is where the question of what are your aims comes in, because if you have no plan, if the two-state solution is ended, you have to think, however unrealistic it might appear, at least pose the question of something else. And I think large parts of the world understand this now. Instinctively, it's true that in Europe, public opinion now, I mean, there have been a number of polls when they've actually asked, which do you think is the most dangerous state in the world? A fairly large proportion of Europeans, especially the young, reply Israel. Why? Because they know Israel is a nuclear state. They know it's carrying out quite a brutal occupation. They know that the United States backs it. They fear because that there could be an accidental nuclear war. Who knows what as a war of last resort? So there is this growing feeling, which of course the elitist politicians in Europe don't represent and don't reflect. But some big shift and some big movement within the region itself could spark off real mass struggles or movements to put huge pressure on the governments of Europe and, I hope, North America. I mean, the thing about Bernie Sanders' campaign, which I should say, is that in all my memory of American politics, my own memories and experience, I have not seen a campaign like this. Someone will correct me if I'm wrong. That a campaign to become the candidate of a mainstream party virtually launches a huge popular movement and a popular political movement, not a single issue movement, in this country. Now, I know at the Left Forum there are many critics of Bernie, and fine, that's normal. But it's not even a question of his person, actually, in some ways. Why couldn't anyone else have triggered such a movement off? Precisely because of he's different from the others. People feel that. It was the same with Jeremy Corbyn in Britain. And when people were asked, but how can you like him? Pollster said, but why do you like him? The reply came, because he's different from the politicians. And the politicians are quite a hated subgrouping now, globally, but especially in Europe. And the fact that I think Sanders is the first serious senior politician of a political party who did not go to AIPAC, that does mark a small breakthrough, and we should be grateful.
Yeah.
because that breaks... It does just break, it breaks the hold this organization has over the political structure. I mean, no other country, this is an imperial power, the most powerful country in the world, and after 9/11, both the Senate and the House voted a blank check to Israel. Whatever you do, we will support you. Whatever you do, you can wipe out the entire Palestinian nation and we will support you. Unheard of. Unheard of. So as time proceeds and as the decades pass by, it would be great to mark the 50th anniversary of the occupation, being able to celebrate something, and the lifting of the siege of Gaza, the sanctions on Gaza, the victimization of Gaza would be a huge step forward. So on that I'm in total agreement. It's not enough, of course, but it could be the pattern and the launch pad for something much, much bigger in the region. Because what is clear is that there's going to be no help from any other Arab state. Not that, there was too much even before this, but at least during the days of Nasser and Arab nationalism, they tried, they gave them refuge, they trained them, they gave them weapons, they helped. That's all gone now, with the Saudi Arabians effectively on the same line as the Israeli government. Think about that. The most hardened faction within Islam, the Wahhabis, literalists, Islamic literalists, effectively on exactly the same line as Israel because of factional disputes against their rivals within Islam and because they are now fearful that something might happen inside their own country. So it's a very strange situation which releases the Palestinian movement in many ways from the Saudis and from these other countries, which helps a mass movement if it's politically and psychologically independent of some extremely unpleasant regimes in that region.
Tariq Ali, speaking on the future of Palestine here on New World Notes. Thanks to David Schoenfeld, my colleague at WWUH in West Hartford, for making available the complete audio recording, which I have edited and condensed for radio broadcast. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, thanking you for listening, inviting you to check out our website, newworldnotes.blogspot.com, advising illegitimi non carborundum, and hoping you'll tune in again next week. Ciao.